Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the Big Car Podcast. Last week I talked about the first generation Range Rover, maybe the only bright spot in British Leyland in the 1970s. This is the second part of the story where the Range Rover was refreshed after over 20 years. It's a story with a few twists and turns as the company that makes the car gets passed from pillar to post, and the people working on the car need to ignore all of this as best they can and focus on making the best car with what parts they have from their new parent company. Anyway, on with the show. When we left the Range Rover, it had risen from a farm workhorse to a school-run fashion accessory, but in the process, it had turned into a steady seller that was keeping Land Rover afloat, despite no update for 24 years. So what happened after that long overdue facelift? This is the second part of the Range Rover story. Land Rover was owned by the government throughout most of the 1980s, but was sold to British Aerospace in 1988. That same year, the new owners approved a Range Rover update. Even British Aerospace, with their tight fiscal control, realised that the Range Rover wasn't the golden goose that was going to lay forever. After 18 years with no major updates, at some point the competition was going to catch up and the Range Rover would be finished, so it needed money for a refresh, and that refresh needed to be done properly. The new Range Rover wasn't the only new Land Rover in development. The lower price Discovery had started development 2 years before, in 1986. It would take on the likes of the Toyota Land Cruiser, Mitsubishi Shogun and Isuzu Trooper that were eating into Land Rover's market share. Bringing this mid-level car into Land Rover's lineup would allow the Range Rover to continue its push up market. While the Discovery would use the running gear from the previous Range Rover, the new Range Rover's chassis would be thoroughly updated. The lowly Defender was all but abandoned as Land Rover went chasing more affluent customers. When a car has been around for so long without changing, its shape can become iconic. That happened to the Mini, to the Beetle, and to the Jaguar XJ. When the humble London Taxi was updated, the boxy design wasn't embraced to people's hearts like the Austin from the 1950s. Updating a classic design is hard, and it's easy to be on the receiving end of a pitchfork-wielding mob if you get it wrong. Land Rover were aware of this when they tendered for a new Range Rover shape. Five designs would be considered, from Bertone, partners Hefferman and Greenlee, Ital Design, Pininfarina, and from Land Rover's internal design team. These designs were whittled down to just two, Bertone's and Land Rover's. Customer clinics made it clear that conservative customers wanted the classic Range Rover shape that had been produced by Land Rover's in-house team. However, it's dangerous to let customer clinics guide development. As Henry Ford didn't say, but probably should have, if I'd have asked people what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse. It's hard for customers to make a leap to something new when they want the same comfortable thing they know, only better. Sometimes revolutionary products aren't understood by customer clinics, but are embraced by customers when they're launched. In this case, though, the conservative route was likely the right course to take. There wasn't effective luxury off-roading competition at this time. It was clear that the Range Rover was competing not with cars like the Toyota Land Cruiser, but with the BMW 7 Series and Mercedes S-Class. So the interior needed a level of refinement that would allow it to compete with its German rivals. But with a limited budget, this refinement meant delving into the Rover 800 parts bin, and given the limited level of refinement of Rover parts at that time, the Range Rover was always going to be fighting with one hand tied behind its back. The chassis was stiffened with 1990s level crash structures and improved safety such as side impact bars. Further sound deadening made for a quieter, more refined cabin. The previous car had been updated to use air suspension in 1992, and the new car would come with it as standard. This allowed the ride height to be adjusted, so it could be low to help with cornering on the open road and high for ground clearance while off-roading. And although the Range Rover rarely went off-road, it sold as one of the finest off-roaders that could go anywhere, so it was important that the new car had all the 4x4 ability the old car had, whilst being better on the highway. Like the classic Range Rover before it, the new car would use the venerable Rover V8 engine, first used by Buick in 1961 and famously used by the Rover SD1. But it was improved and enlarged to 4 litres and 4.6 litres. While the 200 TDI was meant to be the future diesel engine for all Land Rover's cars, the unrefined engine wasn't considered for the luxury Range Rover, even though by the time the Range Rover launched, it had been enlarged to the 300 TDI. Land Rover's quest to find the perfect diesel led them to BMW's M51 six-cylinder, used in their 3, 5 and 7 series. With a tweaked torque curve, it worked well for Land Rover's new 2-ton beast, although it was a little underpowered. While the Land Rover Discovery took just 3 years to make it to market, arriving on the scene in 1989, it would take a leisurely 6 years for the new Range Rover to appear. When it did arrive, the press praised the car, but in truth, it wasn't the all-round success 6 years of development should have produced. But it was enough to keep customers flocking to Land Rover dealers around the world. Although development of the Range Rover was started the year British Aerospace took the company over, it would be launched under new owners BMW just 7 months after their takeover in February 1994. With BMW and Rover both producing around 500,000 cars a year, BMW hoped it would catapult them past Mercedes-Benz and allow them to compete with volume car makers Volkswagen. But the jewel in Rover's crown, at least as far as BMW was concerned, was the Range Rover, further expanding BMW's share of the luxury car market. BMW's first plan for the Range Rover was to replace the Rover V8 petrol engines with something from BMW's stable, and to uprate the 2.5-litre diesel engine to 3 litres. Along with this, BMW investigated a super luxury stretch version that could sell for over £100,000. But it became clear to BMW that Land Rover's quality wasn't as high as BMW's. During a blindfolded test, the car's quality was torn apart, and it became clear that the Range Rover wasn't ready for this price category just yet. This also showed that instead of focusing on the 1998 refresh, they should start again with a completely new version. The refresh was scaled back, the new Discovery was delayed, and the Range Rover engine updates were put on hold so Land Rover could focus entirely on delivering a new Range Rover that would have the quality BMW thought it deserved. Rover's evergreen V8 engine would live for yet another day. But this didn't stop Land Rover from producing high-end luxury models for its wealthy clientele. Since 1993, the Range Rover could be customised through Land Rover's autobiography programme, and this continued with a new 1994 model. And it was a popular choice for its rich customers, delivering some much-needed additional revenue. They could choose from any external colour, from a wide variety of the finest leather and wood interior finishes, wheel designs, technology gadgets, and other body styling packages. With the autobiography programme a success, Land Rover decided to offer a standardised package as the Vogue SE version in 1998, initially limited to just 220 cars, but that run was expanded, with the Vogue being a popular option. But in 2000, BMW had had enough of its British experiment. With one stroke of the pen, BMW sold Land Rover to Ford. It's easy to see why BMW would want to offload Rover, as that was still losing money hand over fist, but it's harder to see why they would want to sell Land Rover. BMW stated the company wasn't making a profit, but that may be due to the massive injection of capital for the Range Rover replacement. But the Discovery, Freelander and Range Rover were popular cars, and if you're not making a profit when your cars are selling well, then you're doing something wrong. Land Rover's portfolio complemented BMW beautifully. The Discovery was a popular 4x4 alternative to cars like BMW's 5 Series, and the Range Rover was bought by 7 Series owners. So why sell Land Rover, especially as it was a mark BMW was so keen to get its hands on just 5 years earlier? It's not clear, but it seems it all came down to money. Rover had been sucking BMW dry to the tune of almost £1 billion every year and was still losing £2.5 million a day. The English patient that had bankrupted British Leyland in 1975 and continued to lose taxpayer money into the 1980s was still on its deathbed despite BMW's funding. BMW would pay a further £500 million to the new owners just so Rover wouldn't go immediately broke. And don't forget the £529 million BMW paid British Aerospace for the company in the first place. Not even BMW's deep pockets could take a pounding like this, which probably explained Bernd Pietersrieder's exasperation with the British government over further funding to keep Rover alive. BMW had to jettison Land Rover just to raise cash, only being able to keep the Mini brand. So Ford bought Land Rover for a cool £2.3 billion to add to its 1989 Jaguar purchase despite it supposedly losing money. Ford inherited a new Range Rover that was essentially ready to release, and it had been well funded by a company that knew how to make luxury cars. Ford knew how to sell in the lucrative North American market, which could further expand Range Rover sales. But funding the Range Rover had been done at the expense of the Land Rover Discovery. Development of the new Range Rover had begun at BMW's engineering centre in Munich, as Rover's Gaydon design centre was busy on the Mini replacement. But it transferred to Land Rover's Solihull factory soon after Ford's purchase. However, even after Ford's purchase, BMW was involved in the development of the new Range Rover to ensure the car could be brought to market smoothly. One issue Ford had with the new car was the amount of BMW parts it used. Ford negotiated the use of these parts, but soon got to work to remove them so they could use parts they had control over. The new car would use BMW's engines, the 4.4-litre V8 petrol and the 2.9-litre diesel from BMW's 5 Series, all allied to a 5-speed automatic. For the first time, the Range Rover wouldn't have a manual option. It would use the electronics and in-car entertainment system from the BMW 5 Series. As such, the car was much more reliable, both electronically and mechanically, than the outgoing car. For the first time, the Range Rover used a unibody design. Previously, it had used a body-on-frame construction to maximise its abilities off-road. But this made for a heavier car and produced far too much body roll on fast country roads. To ensure the car would still cut it off-road, the car would lean on its air suspension system. The car's ride height would rise to tackle off-road obstacles, and where the previous Land Rover used a live axle that allowed for dramatic acrobatics while off-roading, the new car used its air suspension system to perform similar tricks. The air suspension would also lower while on the open road and could be used to counteract body roll. It was a win-win, and it was more reliable than on the old car where the suspension could lower by itself when not in use. The car continued to get more luxury features, such as multi-zone air conditioning and seats that both heated and cooled. Customer and press reaction to the new car was unanimous. This was the best Range Rover yet. Ford released an updated Discovery in 2004, and they decided to produce an upmarket version as the Range Rover Sport the following year. While initially this seemed to hurt sales of the regular Range Rover, it soon became a second revenue stream for Land Rover, quickly increasing sales of both models. Where Land Rover had sold almost 21,000 Range Rovers in the USA and Europe in 2002, just 4 years later, sales of the Range Rover line had more than tripled to 64,000 cars. 2005 was also the year MG Rover had to call in the receivers. Since BMW's 2000 sale of Rover, BMW had held onto the Rover mark name to ensure the new company couldn't use the Rover name in North America, which might devalue the Land Rover brand. In 2005, they sold the Rover mark to Ford, reuniting the Rover and Land Rover brands that had been inseparable since Land Rover's inception in the late 1940s. The 2005 Range Rover offered the 4.2-litre Jaguar V8. The following year, Ford added a 4.4-litre version, deleting the BMW petrol engine. Ford removed more BMW parts from the car, and the infotainment system was updated with one from a Ford-approved supplier. The BMW diesel that Land Rover had been so keen to use in 1994 was swapped in 2007 for a new large Ford diesel that was mainly used for Jaguars and Land Rovers, but also farmed out to PSA for the Citroën C5 and Peugeot 407. This was a much more powerful unit than the outgoing diesel, giving the Range Rover some serious grunt. Its interior was improved with Range Rover Sport parts, and it got better brakes, suspension and four-wheel drive system. With all this work integrating the Range Rover into the Ford family, it was a shock when Ford put both Jaguar and Land Rover up for sale in 2007. From the outside, it didn't seem to make much sense, but Ford had a good reason. Like BMW in 2000, it was in financial trouble. They'd already jettisoned their controlling stake in Aston Martin earlier that year, but they needed to get rid of not just Land Rover, but Jaguar as well. In fact, Jaguar was the main problem. Land Rover was profitable, but if Ford was losing money, Jaguar was hemorrhaging it, to the tune of £476 million per year. The S-Type and X-Type that Ford had such high hopes for had both failed to set the world on fire. With both companies being so intertwined, it made sense to sell them as a two-for-one offer. After all, who would buy Jaguar if it was losing so much money? Better to sweeten the pot by selling both companies together. So just 6 years after the BMW experiment had ended, Land Rover found the for sale notice once again hanging outside their factory gates. After a long search, Ford finally selected Indian mega corporation Tata, who offered £1 billion. That might sound like a lot, but it was about half of what Ford paid for Jaguar in 1989 and Land Rover in 2000. Ford was luckier than it knew at the time, though, because just months after the deal concluded in 2008, the world was hit by the Great Recession that drove both its American competitors, General Motors and Chrysler, into bankruptcy. After spending big to get the British car company's engineering know-how and to help expand their Indian car operations, Tata was forced to get a £340 million loan from the European Investment Bank to tie Jaguar and Land Rover over while they got Jaguar back into the black. Despite the recession hitting luxury products hard, sales were still strong, and the Range Rover line would be increased with the Range Rover Evoque in 2011. The car had been in development since 2006 and was a major departure for the large luxury Range Rover. It was shorter than the already small Land Rover Freelander. Land Rover was following the pattern of German car companies who were making ever smaller versions of their luxury saloons and crossovers. And talking of competition, while the Range Rover had the market pretty much to itself in the 1990s, by 2011 the luxury SUV market was getting crowded. We had the Audi Q7, BMW X5, Mercedes M-Class and the Lexus LX. Heck, even Porsche had muscled in on the game with their SUV, sports car, whatever it was, the Cayenne. Where Land Rover had previously tried to expand their range using the Land Rover brand, this time it was a luxury Range Rover brand that would be used. This made sense as the brand had real cachet. If you could buy a Mini BMW, why not a Mini Range Rover? The Evoque was brought to life by Jerry McGovern. Jerry was born in Coventry, just down the road from Land Rover's Solihull factory, and spent his early career at Chrysler in the UK before moving to Austin Rover in 1982. He created the MG EXE concept before becoming the lead designer on the MGF. After this, he switched to Land Rover, where he led design work on the Freelander and he led the team who created the 2002 Range Rover. After this, he'd been lured away to rejuvenate the design of American Lincolns and Mercurys, but by 2004 he'd returned to Land Rover. The Range Rover Evoque started off as the LRX concept in 2008 and had been well received. Jerry McGovern said at the launch, "It's a Land Rover that would be comfortable on Bond Street or Fifth Avenue, but wouldn't flinch at getting its wheels dirty." Land Rover clearly understood its customers. It's a testament to the original design that the Evoque changed so little on the outside, although the interior was watered down a little. Jerry McGovern would be at the heart of Land Rover's raft of new cars from now on. So by 2011, we now had three different Range Rover models: the small Range Rover Evoque, larger Range Rover Sport, and the original Range Rover. And those expensive autobiography versions were still available, meaning you could spend a lot, or a boatload, for Land Rover's top-of-the-line car. But the Evoque was the first Range Rover that would be produced overseas as well as in the UK. Thanks to Tata's 2011 £5 billion investment in the company, what followed was updates to both the Range Rover in 2012 and the Range Rover Sport in 2013, producing a completely updated product line to take on the best the competition could throw at it. The fourth generation Range Rover launched 42 years after the original. It shows Land Rover's tumultuous history that each generation had been launched by a different owner. The design language from the Evoque was clear in this car, and it would continue to be used across the Land Rover range. The new car would use an all-aluminium monocoque for the first time, saving 420 kilograms over the old car. And all those weight savings meant the car was only 436 kilograms heavier than the original Range Rover, despite all the extra gadgets and safety features. That's quite an accomplishment. It also grew 55 centimetres in length over the original car to provide more legroom. The Jaguar V8 was improved and a new V6 was added. That Ford diesel was still available, along with a new 4.4 litre V8 built in Mexico. Range Rover was clearly pushing ever higher in making this car a go-anywhere palace on wheels. The interior was attempting to leave its competition behind and push into Bentley territory. But the new car would have a price to match. The starting price was just shy of £70,000. The car retained its amazing off-roading capabilities. The permanent four-wheel drive used a two-speed transfer case for high and low gears and was controlled with an eight-speed automatic gearbox. The air suspension had been improved, so it provided even better active roll prevention on fast corners while offering excellent off-roading. Think of this as a spiritual successor to Citroën's hydropneumatic suspension. The terrain response system was like a sort of advanced traction control system, providing the best grip on different surfaces. Long wheelbase and autobiography editions were released a year later. The next generation Range Rover Sport used the same platform as the new Range Rover, and this platform will be used by several Jaguars and other Land Rovers. Land Rover obviously didn't think three different Range Rovers were enough when they introduced the Range Rover Velar in 2017. Size-wise, it fit between the small Range Rover Evoque and larger Range Rover Sport. It shared its platform with the Jaguar F-Pace to reduce development costs and help expand its business. And that business was certainly growing. In 1997, Land Rover sold just over 20,000 Range Rovers in its main export market, the US and Europe. The year the Velar launched, Land Rover sold 273,000 Range Rovers around the world. The investment Tata had put in the business certainly seemed to be paying off. And why not? Range Rovers were well put together cars that did just what their rapidly growing customer base wanted. If you wanted a bit more sportiness in your SUV, they were happy to supply a Jaguar that could satisfy your needs. And with celebrities around the world using the Range Rover, the cachet of the brand continued to grow. Land Rover continued to update its suite of Range Rovers when the Evoque got an update in 2018, and as electric cars moved into the mainstream, Jaguar Land Rover and old frenemy BMW joined forces on electric car development in 2019. The Range Rover was never something ecologists could love, but over the years Land Rover has made small efforts to improve its environmental footprint. Many of the materials in the fourth generation car are sustainably sourced and are more recyclable. In 2018, the car became a plug-in hybrid for the first time, using a 2-litre four-cylinder engine used on smaller Jaguars and Land Rovers. The battery pack allowed the heavy Range Rover to get 31 miles without using its engine. When I make videos about British cars, the story rarely has a happy ending. Yes, Jaguar Land Rover made a loss last year due to falling diesel sales and weak sales in China, and yes, they had to lay off some people in 2019 and 2020, but in general, the company's sales are growing. The consolidated Jaguar Land Rover business is certainly more stable and profitable than it was when Tata took it over in 2008. It's grown to be a force to be reckoned with as customers move away from saloons and estates and towards crossovers and SUVs. And the Range Rover itself is most certainly a success story. What started as a replacement to the Land Rover that could work well both on and off-road has morphed into, excuse the pun, a range of cars that are successful around the world and continue to grow in sales. Since I made this video in 2020, Jaguar Land Rover have launched a fifth generation version of the Range Rover in 2022 using a new MLA Flex platform. It's a pretty heavy platform, which is really felt on the smaller Range Rover Sport, which uses the same platform. The Range Rover still has a plug-in hybrid, but this time it has more range, about 50 to 60 miles. But for the most part, the Range Rover was more of the same, more luxury, more power, and more money. There's a long wheelbase option now with 7 seats and all-wheel steering for getting your long wheelbase monster out of tight parking spots. Jaguar Land Rover know there are many people who will pay for the best, and they intend to keep it ahead of its rivals. But the Jaguar Land Rover business isn't actually doing that well. They sold 614,000 cars in 2018, but that's fallen to 354,000 in 2023. That's just a little bit more than half of the amount from 2018. Some of that's COVID supply issues, but other car companies are bouncing back and doing better than ever. So to keep the Range Rover competitive, they really need to start selling more cars. As always, if you like these podcasts, then tell your friends and relatives, even the dodgy relatives. If you want to see it along with many, many other car histories, then take a look at my YouTube channel. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you in the next episode.